go ahead and get started. Thanks for coming on this late session on a Friday night. I'm Heidi Gaiman, and I teach theology and ethics at Hartford Seminary, which is the United Church of Christ Seminary in Connecticut. And today we're talking about Augustine's Confessions, which is basically his autobiography. The theme for tonight is conversion, and the sections I'm focusing on are books 7 and 8. This is in some ways the climax of the whole life story of Augustine. But just by way of form here, I'm going to start off with a little prayer and again a very brief introduction to Augustine for the new faces. The prayer I have been reading all week is from book 1, the first paragraph. Another way you can think about the Confessions is that it is a whole entire prayer to God or a conversation with God, but it's also many other things as well. But let me just read the first paragraph here of book 1 for our opening prayer. Can any praise be worthy of the Lord's majesty? How magnificent the Lord's strength, how inscrutable the Lord's wisdom. Humanity is one of your creatures, Lord, and our instinct is to praise you. We bear about us the mark of death, the sign of our own sin, to remind us that you thwart the proud. But still, since we are a part of your creation, we wish to praise you. The thought of you stirs us so deeply that we cannot be content unless we praise you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you. Amen. Okay, St. Augustine, brief review. He was born in 394 of the Common Era in Sagaste, which is a small town in northern Africa, basically now rural Algeria. And he talks in the text very little about his father, Patricus. He was a pagan and at some point in Augustine's teens converted and then died shortly thereafter. Augustine talks a lot in the text about his mother, Monica, and we haven't really discussed that at all this week, but that is something that many scholars pay attention to in its own right. Who was Monica for him? Why was she so important? And why did he elevate her so? So if you want to read about that, you can get the text at the bookstore and figure out for yourself what you think about his relationship with his mother. He studied and taught in Carthage. He taught rhetoric. He studied law. He also then moved on, as we learned over the last few days, to teach in Rome and Milan. He did return to Africa after his mother's death, and that's when he was persuaded to become a bishop in the Catholic Church, or in the Christian Church at that time. And this, of course, was after his conversion, and that's what we're going to get to today. So he was made bishop, or he was made, I guess, an assistant to the current bishop in 396, and he wrote the Confessions in 397. And again, just to review, I have been suggesting that the Confessions, of course, it's a spiritual autobiography. It's a very intellectual autobiography through which Augustine tells his own story, and there are many ways to read it, but I've been suggesting that it was primarily, or at least one important reason for him to write it, was as a pastoral text to draw people into his own story and hopefully make their Christian commitment deeper because of the way they see him living out his story. And we'll see what that has to do today with conversion and how he likes to think about that. So it's part prayer and praise to God, it's part narrative of his life, it's philosophical and theological reflection. And I have to say, we're really skimming across the surface of a lot of stuff here, but that's the nature of a conversation like this. There's a lot going on. So it's Augustine's invitation to us, and we're sort of working through it book by book. So for today, I want to talk about the theme of conversion. And once again, these themes are present throughout the text. We first talked about the restless heart, and you heard about that in the first paragraph, the prayer I just read to you, that Augustine had a restless heart. And in retrospect, he realizes the restless heart does not rest until it finds God, or rather, until God finds it. And then the other themes we've covered were sin and evil. That was very exciting, I must say, to talk about sin and evil in Augustine. 2 days ago was friendship, today conversion, and tomorrow happiness. But these themes run throughout the text. So I want to start today by asking you what conversion is. What is conversion? What happens in a conversion? Do you already know what you think it is? Have you had one? We can talk about whether you had one later. Who can define conversion? Anyone want to take a shot at it?
A change of heart?
Change of heart?
I was going to say the ascent of the heart.
An ascent of the heart. Can you say a little bit more about that?
To say yes. God says to Augustine, I love you. And it's an offer, it's a promise, and he says yes.
Yeah. So he finally receives it. Yeah. Okay.
I believe that. Yeah. I trust that your word.
Okay. Others?
A turning.
A turning, right? Anyone else want to offer?
It can be an ongoing process of conversion, I think.
Yeah, and for Augustine, it seems like he had very many dramatic conversions in his life, turning points where suddenly something strikes him. And of course, again, this whole narrative is told from the perspective of, you know, post-final conversion for him. But I think for many of us, we wonder if we had a conversion. I mean, if you were raised in the church, you know, a particular church, or just as a Christian, we wonder, you know, yeah, at some point I accepted this and was baptized, but did I have a dramatic conversion event? And people who have had dramatic conversions often like to tell the story because it tells others something about their experience of God and who they are now. And I think possibly also for the same reason Augustine wants to talk about that, which is to draw people in. You know, I have had this dramatic moment. Don't you want the same thing for your life?
You were talking, I think, yesterday, perhaps, about his association, his alliances in Rome. And that there was, you mentioned a church that he belonged to where there was an evil God and a good God. And I wonder if you could just define that again or mention it again. It wasn't Christian.
No, it was the Manichae, the followers of Mani, where they were called the Manichaeans, and this is one of Augustine's conversions. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, but for Augustine, he had particular pressing questions that he needed answered. And the primary one was, what is the source of evil? And for him, the Manichaean cult or tradition gave him an answer for that, which is there's a good God and there's a bad God. So the source of evil in the world are these two forces interacting. The good God is not like the Christian tradition, the transcendent God against whom nothing can succeed. No, the Manichaeans believed there was a battle going on. No one God, neither of these gods was more powerful than the other. And so that was his Manichaean phase, which lasted about 9 years. Does that answer?
Yeah, then I don't know that it was you, but someone in our group mentioned something about the virtuous life in Rome, kind of what he was expected to do, how he defined his position in the community.
Right. Is that related to the conversion issue, or?
Well, other than him, just that was his alliance at that time.
Right. And there was many competing lifestyles at the time. There was the pagan Roman tradition, which I consider a religious tradition, but it's also considered, I guess. There was that. It was a sort of a civic tradition, but it was also with respect to gods and powers and that. And then there was Manichaean. There was different philosophies, and Augustine really explored a lot of these. And I'll review his various conversions as we go. I'll just throw out, I mean, all these notions of what conversion is, I think, are right. I'll just throw out a possible definition, and that is, it's a fundamental change of the whole person. So a conversion isn't just, you know, something small that happens. It's a fundamental change of the entire person through which one becomes different and yet somehow more truly who one is. So, and part of that is just to say, you know, the assumption is that there's truth out there, and if you convert towards something that you think is true, it's going to more fundamentally allow you to become who you are. Because living in the truth allows you to live to the fullest. That's one way to talk about it. And there's many ways to talk about conversion too, and some theorists have different kind of stages or different types of conversion, an emotional conversion, an intellectual conversion. And I think for Augustine, a lot of his conversions were very intellectual. You know, they were a rational coming to a decision about what the truth was and how he was going to follow it. And I think he continued, at least the way he writes it, he continued to feel like his heart was never converted. Again, going back to the restless heart theme, he never felt like, despite the fact that he was convinced intellectually about something, at least for a time, he never felt at peace because his heart wasn't converted. So it's an intellect, conversion involves the intellect and the emotion, I think. So let me just talk briefly about Augustine's conversions in the text. Do you remember what they were? We have the conversion to Manichaeism was one of them. Anyone else remember a conversion who was in some of the earlier classes?
Yeah, he had a sense of friendship, and his idea of friendship changed, I think, along the way. I don't know that you'd say that was a conversion, but it was a big...
Yeah.
Important part of his life.
Yeah, I guess I would read that as his final conversion, you know, which is the perspective from which he's writing, casts judgment on his initial friendships in life, and he judges them as not being oriented towards God. So yeah, that's part of the whole transformation of his life. Well, let me just point to a couple things in the text here. I believe it's in... That as always, I'm going to kind of reach back to the one previous book that we covered yesterday, and that is, let me see, book 6. It is section 11, and this really, excuse me, is kind of Augustine reviewing his own conversions, and some of this might be familiar to you when I read it. I'll just start here, and this is written in a style. I don't know if I'll be able to read it properly because after each kind of reflection in the text, there's a dot dot dot, like as if he's saying, you know, he wants to say something, and then he's kind of pausing. Wait a minute, that didn't quite work. So I'll try to indicate that. Okay, so here he is, and he's looking back and saying, talking about his memories of when he was younger and all these conversions he went through, and he says this. Tomorrow I shall discover the truth. I shall see it quite plainly, and it will be mine to keep. Faustus will come and explain everything. The academics, what wonderful men they are. Is it true that we can never know for certain how much we ought to manage? I'm sorry. Is it true that we can never know for certain how we ought to manage our lives? No, no, not that. We must search all the more carefully and never despair. I can see now that the passages in Scripture, which I used to think were absurd, are not absurd at all. They can be understood in another sense quite fairly. I shall fix my foot firmly on the step where my parents set me as a boy until I find the manifest truth. But where and when am I to look for it? Ambrose had no time to spare, and I have no time for reading. Where am I to look for the books I need? Where and when can I buy them or get someone to lend them to me? I must plan my time and arrange my day for the good of my soul. Great hope is born in me. because I have found that the doctrines of the Catholic faith are not what I had thought them to be, and my accusations were unfounded. The learned men of the church hold it wrong to believe that God is limited by the shape of a human body. Why then do I hesitate to knock so that the door may be opened to reveal what is still hidden from me? So there's a kind of review of his searching and his finding something up until this point in the text. He's saying, you know, at first I thought, we talked about his discovery of philosophy through Cicero's Hortensius, and this is the idea that what we are about is the pursuit of wisdom. And he was really gripped by that. And he said, he notes how many of the other students or teachers talking about rhetoric would read Cicero because of the beautiful language and that sort of thing. He found in Cicero this definition of philosophy as the love of truth, the desire to pursue wisdom. And he went with that. He thought, this is where I'm going to figure things out. That is what I would consider his first conversion. And then Faustus, if you remember, was one of the Manichees. And he had converted to Manichaeism. He felt like this explained his problem with evil, but he was waiting for the great Faustus. And of course, when Faustus comes, he's a very well-spoken person, and he tries to answer Augustine's questions, but even Faustus himself admits he can't answer everything. So then, and we didn't really talk about this one, when I said the academics, that's a reference to Cynic philosophers who were doubters. They said, actually, we have no way of ever knowing anything, and we should just be, you know, cynical, not in the way we use the term, cynical about life, to say, you really can't know. And he found that appealing for a while. And then, if you remember, too, we talked about his discovery through Bishop Ambrose, that scripture wasn't as shallow or simplistic as he thought. You know, compared to Cicero, he found the scriptures lacking. But suddenly, when Ambrose preaches, he begins to see, and in fact, what the real realization for Augustine there is that scriptures are not purely a straightforward text. They're not making a clear philosophical argument. You can read scriptures as metaphor. And that's really what Ambrose gave him, is this idea of reading scriptures on a spiritual level rather than just a straightforward argument. And so then you see in this reflection, he mourns the fact that, as we saw, that Ambrose was not available to actually sit down with him and be pressed about Augustine's specific questions about evil and the being of God. Well, that's the fifth conversion was... And we didn't really discuss this either, but this is a kind of a lot of what happens forward here in Book 7. This conversion to the fact that the doctrines of the Christian Church are not necessarily false or ridiculous, and in fact what they explain for Augustine is one of the other pressing questions he had, and this is a question we're not going to talk about at all, but he couldn't comprehend an immaterial God. He kept trying to figure out where God was, and he was thinking of a physical body. And he realized from reading both Plato and the Christian doctrines that there was such a thing as immaterial reality. And in fact, he was using it all the time. He describes the fact that even as I'm thinking here, I have my thoughts, but where are they? They're not a physical thing. And so might God not be immaterial? This isn't a question we usually struggle with, so I'll spare you the philosophical agony of talking about a material versus an immaterial God. So that's basically a review of, at this point in the text, of Augustine and where he is. And again, in Book 7, he addresses... This is moving forward from what I just read. In Book 7 and 8, he continues this description of his pursuit of the truth and his desire to find a resting place for his heart. But his biggest question still hasn't been answered. And I want to read you how he puts it in Section 3 of Book 7. And I'm going to read, let's see... Not too much of this, but here it is. But although I declared and firmly believed that you are Lord God, the true God who made not only our souls, but also our bodies, and not only our souls and bodies, but all things, living and inanimate as well, although I believe that you were free from corruption or mutation or any degree of change, we won't talk about what that means either. That's the, you know, the immutable God was very popular at that point in time. Okay, so although he has figured this out, I still could not find a clear explanation without complications of the cause of evil. I was told that we do evil because we choose to do so of our own free will and suffer it because your justice rightly demands that we should. I did my best to understand this, but I could not see it clearly. I tried to raise my mental perceptions out of the abyss which engulfed them, but I sank back into it once more. Again and again I tried, but I always sank back. One thing lifted me up into the light of your day. It was that I knew that I had a will, surely as I knew that there was life in me. When I chose to do something, or not to do it, I was quite certain that it was my own self, and not some other person who made this act of will. So that I was on the point of understanding that herein lay the cause of my sin. Again, he's struggling with this issue of sin and evil. And if you remember from the previous discussion, he liked the solutions that put sin and evil external to him. It's in the stars, you know, astrology. It's this evil God battling against the good God within me. Now he seems to be saying, okay, I get it, that sin is somehow within me, that evil is somehow my own doing. And then he says, but then I would ask myself once more, who made me? Surely it was my God, who is not only good, but goodness itself. How then do I come to possess a will that can choose to do wrong and refuse to do good, thereby providing a just reason why I should be punished? Who put this will into me? So here's the current struggle of Augustine. Does that sound familiar to you? What's familiar about that description of his struggle now?
Paul,
is that what you were going to say?
No, I was going to say it's mine.
Right. It should be familiar to us if it's a description of the human condition, right? But yeah, I think he's pulling on Paul and this idea that, okay, what's the verse?
I do what I don't want to do, but I don't know the verse.
Yeah, Paul has that verse of why is it that I don't do what I know I should do, and that which I know I shouldn't be doing, that's what I go ahead and do in the end. So it's this battle of the wills. And Augustine is really just describing that very clearly. I don't know, hopefully that resonates, and that's what Augustine, again, is trying to draw us into. Is this your own struggle? If it is, you know, follow with me, keep going. And the remainder of Book 7 is really Augustine's reflection on this, again, very, very intellectual struggle with the problem, but also his own, you know, he feels his will and his heart being pulled in two different directions, and he's struggling to answer the question of the origin of evil, which this is a manifestation of it. Where is it? Is it within me? Then how did it get there? You know, so he's finally saying, okay, it's in me. Who put it there? Why, if you made me God and you're good, how did this happen? And basically, he also has kind of a long conversation in this book with the ideas of Plato, and he was reading, again, he's got this voracious appetite. He goes from one set of texts to another, and at this point in his life, he's reading Plato, and he was reading them, and they did help him, as with everything he read, they helped him make sense of certain things, and for example, the notion of immateriality as a possible way to describe who God is, but he concludes, so I'm going to skip the entire book. He concludes in the last section, which is section 21. Okay. I began to read and discovered that whatever truth I had found in the Platonists was set down here as well. He's talking about now reading the Apostle Paul. So he finds that all of the truths of the Platonists were found, for him at least, in what he was reading in the books of Paul. And then he says, and with it there was praise for your grace bestowed. For St. Paul teaches that he who sees ought not to boast as though what he sees, and even the power by which he sees, had not come to him by gift. For whatever powers he has, did they not come to him by gift? By the gift of grace, he is not only shown how to see you, who are always the same, but it is also given the strength to hold you. Okay, that's a little bit awkward language. Did you hear, understand what he was saying there? Can somebody say it back, or should I read it again? Okay. I began to read and discovered that whatever truth I had found in the Platonists was set down here in St. Paul as well. And with it, there was praise for your grace bestowed. So there he's saying, I found what I had already found in the Platonists here. But also the idea that it is by grace bestowed. So in some sense, I think what he's saying is the Platonists think it's all our own effort to, you know, to borrow this image from Plato, we work ourselves out of the cave. It's up to us to try to see all this more clearly. And he's saying, you know, the ideas of Plato are also found in Paul, but also the notion that we only can come to it by grace. So let me just finish it's just a little bit more about that, what I just read. I'll just read the thing again. For St. Paul teaches that he who sees ought not to boast as though what he sees and even the power by which he sees had not come to him by gift. For whatever power he has, did not they come to him by gift? By the gift of grace, he is not only shown how to see you, who are always the same, but it is also given the strength to hold you. So here he's saying it's by God's gift that we are able to see the truth. And not only that, it's also by God's power that we are able to grasp God and keep a hold of God. And then I'm skipping a little bit, but his conclusion is, none of this is contained in the Platonist books. Their pages have not the mean of the true love of God. They make no mention of the tears of confession or of the sacrifice that you will never disdain, a broken spirit, a heart that is humbled and contrite. Nor do they speak of the salvation of your people, the city adorned like a bride, the foretaste of your spirit, and a lot of this is quotations from biblical texts, or the chalice of our redemption. In them no one sings, no rest has my soul but in God's hands. To him I look for deliverance. I have no other stronghold, no other deliverer but him. Safe in his protection, I fear no deadly fall. Let me just tell you where that's from. That's from Matthew 11. And then he goes on, they disdain his teaching because he is gentle and humble of heart. For you have hidden all this from the wise and revealed it to the little children. Okay, so he's saying, he's at this point of saying, Platonists had some of the truth, but they didn't have this whole kind of more proper mode of being in the world as a creature of God. The Platonists were, you know, charging ahead with their intellect, making their way out of the cave, able under their own power to see in the light of the sun. And for Augustine, he's tried that, you know, and you can believe him, given the passion with which all these pages have been written and the way he describes, the way he flung himself into these various new ideas or, you know, falling at the feet of persons who he thought could answer his questions. He's tried it and he didn't make it.
So where does evil come into this? How does he explain the presence of evil? Or does he?
I think when we talked about the problem of evil and the, you know, this is a whole, he answers the question, you know, in a way in this text, and that is that evil is the negation of being. That is, you strip away what the goodness of reality, and you're left with nothing. That's evil. And so in a way, it's not, you know, living up to your proper form is where evil comes into the world. Because he, in the end, I mean, and despite what people say about Augustine's view of material being and, the body, Augustine said, whatever is good. And he gets that from the creation story. Everything in existence is good. There's no physical being to evil. And he, you know, that's woven into the text. He has other more theoretical works where he directly addresses that problem. But he does come to some conclusion about this, of course, in his experience here. So I think that in what we just read, Augustine sees that the biblical text has a lot more depth to it than philosophy, opposite of what he had previously thought, that it was shallow. And he has read, as he keeps reading to find answers to these deep questions, and that last section that I read, he just feels like there's something more to the biblical text than what he's finding in philosophy. And again, this is a reflection of his own life. His own experience is not, you know, you put all your energy into it and you get there. Just the opposite. He in some ways feels like he's getting further from God, but at this point, he feels like he's moving in the right direction. He's agreed with, intellectually, the church doctrines, and he thinks the answers are in the biblical text, but he hasn't yet converted. So I want to turn now to you guys and say, just to pause here before we dive into book 8, which is the conversion story, just to say, can you identify in your own life a particular problem that, like Augustine has, the problem of evil, or some particular problem that you have been unable to overcome, that has driven your pursuit of knowledge about God or faith? A particular maybe stumbling block, or maybe something that was, and like Augustine, you finally found a solution. Or is your pursuit of knowledge of God and a firmer faith more of a general approach to life? Is there some pinpoint issue that really bothers you?
I'll give an answer to that. Mm-hmm. I think the problem of identity for me is a lifelong struggle. And the simple answer to that identity is I'm a child of God.
Can you describe a little bit more what you mean by the problem of identity?
Well, yeah, I could say it has something to do with having a meaning, finding some meaning, both personally and socially, mm-hmm. And I think also in a relationship of loneliness in the world today, the fast pace, the sort of instant answers that the culture offers, and that so many people are busy with, and in that sense that there's a lot of loneliness that doesn't get resolved by all of the cultural stuff that surrounds me. And so that's something of identity too.
Yeah.
That identity is a social and personal meaning, and that has to get worked out. For me, it feels like Augustine was doing that, working out who you use the expression, his true self, finding his true self.
Right.
He searched and searched and searched, and for me that's something I can identify with, or that's how I identify with the rest.
Yeah. Do you think, can I just ask you one more question? Do you think it's a little bit odd that he has such an intense relationship to this philosophical question of the problem of evil versus, I mean, he also, I agree that you know, he's got the restless heart. He wants to know who he is. But he's almost more driven by what is it, the evil question keeps coming back up again and again. What is evil? How did it get here? Why am I evil? Does that seem odd, or is it maybe just we all have our own unique intellectual question.
I would say that it's a characteristic question of the time. As a Greek, the question of the right, the good, has, if that doesn't sound to me like the zeitgeist of my time,
right,
where my time has to do what's meaningful, what's socially true.
Okay.
Or I'd even say it might be an aesthetic question. What is beautiful? What is the aesthetic of love. What is the loving thing that I'm to be about?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Different sort of zeitgeist.
Yeah, I think that's right on the mark. Was someone over here?
For me, I really got the part about Christ died for our sins. And I really got that to the point where it's really, really judgmental. And I kept looking and looking and looking. And I mean, it's we're always looking. But it was only for me when I went inside myself and realized, you know, that there's a saying, and I don't know what it's related to, but that you are a child of God, precious and free. And it was, instead of looking outside of myself for things, I needed to look inside too and look for forgiveness.
As I reflect upon it, I have almost exactly the opposite sequence as Augustine in my search. And I was raised in a church environment. I also went to a school that was supported by the church.
Could you speak up?
I had just exactly the opposite, which is that I grew up in a Christian environment where not only my church but also my school was steeped in Christianity. And then I went to college and took philosophy and read about Plato's Allegory of the Caves and read how Augustine incorporated the allegory of the cave into the Christian thought and had just exactly the opposite, because what happened to me was I said, what we have in Christianity is not scriptural, but is incorporation of Greek thought into our theology. And so my battle ever since then is to rediscover the grace that Christianity, much of Christianity, is lost.
Well, my questions, my big questions, are ones more of society and corporate, you know, the corporate human thought. You know, that this, the question of evil, why did, you know, someone die in a terrible accident? I don't know the answer to that either, and I think those are fascinating questions, but to me the one that really gets me is, you know, we see where this world is headed, and, you know, things are not necessarily becoming, you know, more understandable or more influenceable even by, you know, someone who's an elite thinker, powerful person. There are forces. It's almost Walter Wink, you know. I mean, his work really speaks to me that, you know, is there some type of, you know, a force or an evil that's running? And where does God fit into that? And where do I as a person fit into that? You know, am I supposed to just, you know, shut down on that and go and serve the poor or look in my own area? And how can I influence and understand that? Do I understand that as the world runs like this and grace runs parallel? I think that, to me, that's the issue of the day. And more people that I talk to who are Christians or who are searching into Christianity are looking at that and saying, so what does Christianity have to say about this?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a lot of reflection in theology on the issue of globalization and how we are to understand it theologically, the way power moves in the world. at an incredible pace for both good and evil. Did you want to jump in?
Well, I having grown up in a fairly fundamental church, I was very concerned from an early age about individual souls. It's very individualistic. And the questions for me that move me away from that, I think, are related, I think, to the question of evil. First is, how is it that we are allowed to maim and kill one another? Because that, A, you know, from the other perspective, takes away your opportunity to be saved, to have a relationship to God, and also to see the destruction that follows on violence of different kinds. And then, reflecting a little farther, how is it that so much of what we do has unintended results? That the intentions that we have do not necessarily shape the outcome. That seems like an unjust world to me.
Yeah.
I'm still there.
Yeah. And that's a different question than the, you know, the struggle of the will to do or not to do something. That doesn't even address the question of, then I actually choose to do the right thing, I do it, and then there's an unintended consequence. Yeah. So Augustine doesn't really push it there. Well, that's all just to you know, indicate that everybody struggles, you know, with their own particular, both, you know, intellectual and heartfelt needs and questions. You know, do you struggle? I mean, the way I read Luther is that he was agonized over this forgiveness issue and not being able to do the good. And he, you know, he experienced salvation by coming to terms with that. But Augustine has the question of evil that he's struggling with, as well as this notion of, okay, now I'm intellectually there. I think I've found the answer. And we start book 8 with this question of, why can I not move forward with this then? What's the problem here? And so I just want to quickly go through, there's a couple conversion stories in this book that are both Augustine's and two others. I was going to review two of them, but I'll just tell you the one. And the one conversion story Augustine himself hears about is the story of two fellows, and he tells that a friend of his is actually conveying this story to him, so it gets a little complicated. But have you heard of Saint Anthony? Lived out in the desert, monastic.
Desert father.
Yeah, he was one of the desert fathers. So he hears a story about this pair of friends who are coming along and happen to stop at the household, a Christian household, and they find there a text about Saint Anthony, and they pick it up and take a look at it. And let me read you what he says about this. This is in Book 8, Section 6. Don't want to read too much of it here. Okay. In the house, they found a book containing the life of Anthony. One of them began to read it and was so fascinated and thrilled by the story that even before he had finished reading, he conceived the idea of taking upon himself the same kind of life and abandoning his career in the world. Both he and his friend were officials in the service of the state, in order to become your servant, talking to God. All at once, he was filled with the love of holiness. Angry with himself and full of remorse, he looked at his friend and said, "What do we hope to gain by all the efforts we make? What are we looking for? What is our purpose in serving the state? Can we hope for anything better than a court? Can we hope for anything better at court than to be the emperor's friend?" So again, you see, Augustine is going in very high circles here. He's buddies with the emperor, as are these guys. "Even so, surely our position would be precarious and exposed to much danger. We shall meet it at every turn, only to reach another danger which is greater still. And how long is it to be before we reach it? But if I wish, I can become the friend of God at this very moment." And then he describes how this guy turns back to the book, and from his friend's perspective, watching him read the book, is that he's laboring with this, like, you know, he's sighing and he's in agony, just like Augustine is always doing the same thing, very passionately reading these texts as if they're life-changing somehow. And lo and behold, he says, I have torn myself free from all our ambitions and have decided to serve God. From this very moment, here and now, I shall start to serve him. If you, he's talking to his friend, if you will not follow my lead, do not stand in my way. The other answered that he would stand by his comrade, for such service was glorious and the reward was great. So these two, now your servants, built their tower at the cost which had to be paid, that is, at the cost of giving up all they possessed, and followed you. And now, okay, so someone is telling Augustine this story of these guys who are reading the life of Anthony and become converted. And meanwhile, Augustine himself is sitting there in this agony of, you know, it's hitting him the same way, sort of the third party out from the life of St. Anthony. And he responds in this way. This is in section 7 and 8. This is what Ponticianus told me, his friend's telling him the story. But while he was speaking, O Lord, you were turning me around to look at myself. Just as what you were describing, he had to look inside to find God, really. For I had placed myself behind my own back, refusing to see myself. You were setting me before my own eyes, so that I could see how sordid I was, how deformed and squalid, how tainted with ulcers and sores. I saw it all and stood aghast, but there was no place where I could escape from myself. If I tried to turn my eyes away, they fell on Ponticianus, still telling his tale. So his friend's still telling the story, and he's, you know, in this agony and wrath. Okay, so he says, I had known it all along, but I had always pretended it was something different. I had turned a blind eye and forgotten it. This, you know, the filth that he sees in himself. And so he goes on to say, as a youth, I had been woefully at fault, particularly in early adolescence. I had prayed to you for a chastity, that is, you know, sexual purity, and said, give me chastity and continence, but not yet. That's one of the other famous quotes from Augustine besides the restless heart quote is, oh Lord, give me chastity, but not yet. And so he sees himself, you know, that he's sought the truth, and he sought the truth, but he's just somehow been unable to finally turn there. And so he reads this as being totally at odds with himself. Again, this notion of two wills. I know what I want to do, but I can't do it. And some of us have experienced this. Have had this experience of two minds in your own self battling one another. And Augustine says earlier in the book that just to illustrate why he's going through, and again, there's another conversion story that he tells. He says, when converts are well known, like himself, their example guides many, many others to salvations. So again, he makes it obvious. He's telling his story so that many other will follow. And in fact, his own conversion sort of follows along with the conversion of these other people. And the other thing to notice here is that for the conversion story I just read to you, it's among friends. Again, you know, the one friend converts and takes the other with him. And for Augustine, that's always a very important part of the story. You don't just do this on your own. Yes, it's always very internal. It's a personal meeting of God, but it's always in the context of, how does this work? You know, what are you doing? And I'm going here. Will you come with me? And they pursue the knowledge together. So now I want to read the final, ultimate story of conversion. How many people of you know the story of Augustine's conversion? Anyone?
I think I've heard it before.
Okay.
You know.
Anyone else? Yeah. So it's some people say that next to St. Paul, this is the one of the most important conversion stories in the Christian tradition. And perhaps, you know, it's not as dramatic as Paul's. I don't know, you decide. But partly it's that it's Augustine's conversion story, and he tells us and we know about it. So here's what he says. There's been a pages and pages of agony, but I'm going to spare For I felt that I was still the captive of my sins, and in my misery I kept crying, how long shall I go on saying tomorrow, tomorrow? Why not now? Why not make an end of my ugly sins at this moment? I was asking asking myself these questions, weeping all the while with the most bitter sorrow in my heart. And here he has gone, I skipped the context, but he has heard the story of Antony. He's talking with his friends about it, and he suddenly, you know, wrenches himself away from the company of friends and falls under a fig tree in a garden. And this is what's happening. Okay, why not make an end of my ugly sins at this moment? I was asking myself these questions, weeping all the while with the most bitter sorrow in my heart, when all at once I heard the sing-song voice of a child in a nearby house. Whether it was the voice of a boy or girl, I cannot say, but again and again it repeated the refrain, "Take it and read, take it and read." At this I looked up, thinking hard whether there was any kind of game in which children used to chant these words, but I could not remember ever hearing them before. I stemmed my flood of tears and stood up, telling myself that this could only be a divine command to open my book of scripture and read the passage on which my eyes should first fall. For I had heard the story of Antony, and I remembered how he had happened to go into a church while the gospel was being read, and he had taken it as counsel addressed to himself when he heard the words, "Go home and sell all that belongs to you. Give it to the poor, and so the treasure you have shall be in heaven, and then come back and follow me." By this divine pronouncement, Antony had at once been converted to you. So I hurried back to the place where Alypius, we've heard about Alypius before, close friend, was sitting. For when I stood up to move away, I had put down the book containing Paul's epistles. I seized it and opened it, and in silence I read the first passage on which my eyes fell. Now, I'll read this passage, but it's not going to be as relevant unless you were here for the sin theme. Here's what he reads. "Not in reveling and drunkenness, not in lust and wantonness, not in quarrels and rivalries, rather arm yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. Spend no more thought on nature and nature's appetites." Augustine is all about appetite. This man is full of desire, and he just can't direct it in the right place. But now he's gotten the word. I had no wish to read more and no need to do so. For an instant, as I came to the end of the sentence, it was as though the light of confidence flooded into my heart and all the darkness of doubt was dispelled. So he goes on and he talks to his friend. He happens to open the book to another passage which seems to have direct reference to Alypius, and they both become saved. Then we went in and told my mother, who was overjoyed. And when we went on to describe how it all happened, she was jubilant with triumph and gloried in you, who are powerful enough and more than powerful enough to carry out your purposes beyond all our hopes and dreams. That's a quote from scripture. For she saw that you had granted her far more than she used to ask in her tearful prayers and plaintive lamentations. You converted me to yourself, so that I no longer desired a wife. I haven't been talking about the wife issue. I no longer desired a wife or placed any hope in this world, but stood firmly upon the rule of faith, where you had shown me to her in a dream so many years before. You turned her sadness into rejoicing, into joy, far fuller than her dearest wish, far sweeter and more chaste than any she had hoped to find in children begotten of my flesh. So that's the conversion story and the end of book 8. What do you make of this conversion story? I mean, how did it finally happen, and are you surprised, or was this what you were waiting for all along? Is it satisfying to you?
Did it stick? Did it really last this time?
It really lasted because this is in 396 when I believe he's 30, almost 32. And a year later, within the next year or two, is when he returns to Africa. His mother dies shortly after this. He returns to Africa and he's called to become bishop. What he really wanted to do at this point was live, and he had gone to live in a community with friends to live out the godly life as an ascetic. But he was called back into service of the church. So it did stick.
Okay. I've heard stories of people who have suffered chronic depression, which is debilitating in so many ways to a person's sense of self and will to live. And where they've heard a simple message that penetrates through the darkness to fundamentally reorient their life. And that's kind of what I hear in this, that intellectually it's, well, he's going to go on and write other books where he reasons out faith and influences the church and history, but this conversion is more, it rings true in its simplicity.
And that's kind of part of what he's saying. I think Augustine may be slightly afraid of the judgment that he himself made early in his life, that Christianity was simplistic. But he's saying, you know, he's trying to convince us that it's in the simplicity and the emphasis on other things like humility, etc., all the things the Platonists don't have, that the truth is actually found.
Well, it's always seemed to me, and I'm not a philosophy student, that there was a fair amount of overthinking among people at that time on, you know, big issues. And whether it was the Platonists or the Christians or the, you know, obviously this guy had a real appetite for that. He wanted to think, he wanted to solve the problems. And I can certainly relate to, at some point, just taking it back some notches. And, you know, the idea that this would come through, you know, a child singing, whether that was a vision of his or whatever, it may have been the only way that God could get through to him. You know, because you can think and think and think, and I'm sure in the academic life you see this all the time, that people's, you know, value and thought, even in a setting of teaching theology, you know, some of the most overthinking people I knew in college were theologians. You know,
why I do ethics.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's at any rate, I it sounds right to me. It sounds right.
Anyone else want to comment on the story?
Kind of like he hit bottom. He was so tortured.
He
almost
was
sounds
tortured.
Russian to me, anyway.
Yeah,
like Dostoevsky or something.
Yeah, and you didn't hear the, you know, eighth of it. It's
yeah.
Like he's in agony. And, you know, again, he's writing this in retrospect, but you have to believe that he's really describing his own experience of the tortured soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that in the story he says, you know, he hears the child's voice. He doesn't know whether it's a boy or a girl,
right.
You know, and I'm not quite sure why he puts that in there, but it's kind of cute. He's saying, you know, I don't know where this voice came from.
It's that still small voice,
yeah.
After the wind and the everything, you know, there's just,
yeah.
There's still a companion there,
yeah.
For him in the deepest part of his torture. And he's not even saying this was the voice of God. It's like he almost can't do that. It was a child. I don't know if it's a male or a female child, but it was a child. In a building nearby. And, you know, maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. But that's as close as he can get to that revelation.
Well, and he, you know, I don't know if it bothers you at all, the kind of superstition of,
right.
You know,
yeah.
You know, this is directly relevant to me. But he takes that definitely as the voice of God, the
yeah.
Scripture that falls
mm-hmm.
to him when he opens the book. And, you know, that's, again, nothing about him and his own pursuit. Well, now I'm going to read, you know, the letter to the Galatians, and this will fit. No, he just gave it up. He finally said, you know, I'm just going to do it. And he saw that in the other conversion stories of Antony walking
surrender.
Into a church service, of these guys happening to stop at a house and pick up a book and reading. It's, you know, suddenly given to you. Again, this idea, it's a gift. Salvation is a gift. There's no way to track it down and pounce on it.
It's surrender.
Can we go back to the very beginning when he talked about he never named his wife and what happened to his child? How does it come full circle for him in that relationship?
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, the concubine in particular is a difficult issue. And I think it's partly, you know, Augustine is spilling out his heart here about everything. And who knows how to read the fact that he doesn't name her. And of course he didn't marry her. It would have been weird if he had. She was clearly not someone of his status. But he was with this woman from the age of 15 to 30. And the conversion to you know, belief in the Christian doctrine, which we didn't, you know, which I described as one of the conversions leading up to this, was the point at which he sent her away. And he doesn't talk about that, and some people say it's because he was so traumatized by this, felt it had to be done, and just, you know, had to put her out of his life, that he doesn't talk about, in the way he talks about, you know, weeping and weeping for a lost friend, or when on the death of his mother, he has this whole, and we might be able to talk about that a little bit tomorrow, because he almost has a whole theory of grief in here, in the end. But he doesn't wrap up the story of the mother of his son. And the death of his son is also another issue. He was very close with his son, and that's clear. So he does, and he names him, so he does talk a little bit more about that. But my guess is a lot of that is cultural. You know, she wasn't ever going to be an important part of his life. She couldn't have been, yet he was clearly committed to her, so. Any other comments, questions? You must share your own conversion experience right now with all of us.
Okay, I believe it's time is up. And once again, thanks for showing up on a Friday night.